Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor. I got this feeling
inside my bones. Thank you, Bob. It goes electric,
wavy when I turn it on. You heard the new JT song?
No. This is it.
This is it. Check it out. We're flying up no ceiling when we in our zone. I got that sunshine in my pocket. Got that good soul in my feet. I feel that hot blood in my body when it drops. Ooh, I can't take my eyes off of it. Moving so phenomenally. Come on, like the way we rock it. So don't stop. Doesn't feel like a summer day outside as much as it has, but doesn't this have a great summer song feel?
Oh, yeah. Well, you already know. So just
imagine. Guy knows how to put out a song, doesn't he? Justin Timberlake's latest. Can't Stop the Feeling. And in fact, Griff, are we going to vibe on that one later on in the show today, ask people what they think?
Well, I didn't even know about it until you sent it to me. So
we'll... I love it. I'm catching you up with current music. Dear Diary.
I know.
The wheels have turned.
No, they haven't. Guess what? They haven't turned.
But no, yeah, it's true. You got to that one before me. So it's still not up on the app yet, but I think it will be by the time we vibe. So maybe we'll talk about that. But I've already got I was planning on bumping into that segment with the new Radiohead song. So,
oh, fair enough. Well, we can do Radiohead. Maybe we could do two, because I just did put that on Vibe Score. It's an app
Great.
You get to score things and comment on them, news, music, TV shows, stuff like that. So that's on there, as well as the Gwen Stefani appearance in Carpool Karaoke, which was kind of fun this week. Did you get a chance to see that too, by the way? I thought that was a fun
I have not caught that one. I can't stop watching the Jimmy Fallon Sticks video, not to detract, but...
Jimmy Fallon Sticks video?
You've not seen this one?
No.
So he and Paul Rudd did an exact shot-for-shot reproduction of the Sticks video from the early 80s, Too Much Time on My Hands.
Wow.
And everything is the same.
I didn't know the world was calling out for that.
It wasn't. It was weird, but it's
seems kind of random, doesn't it?
I can't stop watching it.
It seems like a fitting song choice.
Why? I don't understand.
Too much time on my hands.
Yeah, evidently.
Anybody
not,
that's going to do a shot-for-shot remake of that video might.
That was my music. I don't remember the video, so somebody's got to catch me up on that.
My memory of it was kind of vague. It was like a lot of early 80s videos. You have the band performing, intercut with sort of some sort of narrative. In this case, it was the guys in the band at a bar.
Yeah.
You know, and antics. This wasn't a great video, but it wasn't a bad one.
None of the earliest videos weren't that good. Sometimes they would just like put the camera on a glitter ball or something, you know, just give you something to look at while they were playing the music. I'm speaking to you today from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and in Minneapolis, it's smoggy. It's foggy from those fires in Canada. Can you believe that? You've seen the video or the pictures of those walls of fire people are driving through. It's unbelievable. It's put smoke in the air there, of course, but it's drifted down to southern Wisconsin and southeast Minnesota where I live. And when you walk outside, it smells like the day after a campfire. Everywhere. It's just kind of got this sort of smoggy, smoky feeling. If you came up to me and sniffed my hair, you'd go, you smell like s'mores. That's the kind of odor that the Twin Cities have today. And just one other note about the weather that I'm living in, and it's a little maybe warmer than yours, obviously. The Twin Cities hit 92 degrees yesterday. That breaks an 89 degree record high for yesterday's date. The previous high was 89. We got up to 92 degrees. In fact, Two Harbors, which is along Lake Superior, hit 93 and ties that central Minnesota town with McAllen, Texas, for the hottest spot in the nation. Duluth hit 92 degrees yesterday, breaking its previous record of 82. Usually when you break a record, it's 1 or 2 degrees. By 10 degrees, Duluth smashed its previous record high temperature for at least yesterday's date. This is the first time I've been on the radio since we took a group to Paris And if you're one of that group, you are now my lifelong friends. And if you're not, we had a real nice trip. And one fun thing about flying to Paris from Chicago is that it's not that difficult. It's 8 hours in a plane, mind you. But, you know, they sit you down, and we were just in coach with all the other schlubs. And the movie comes up, and hey, it's Star Wars. And in fact, coming back, it was Creed, was one of the movies. So I watched those two movies coming and going. Each movies that I knew I should have watched, but just never wanted to take the time to. So yeah, you're sitting there in the airplane going, well, I got nothing better to do. I'll read my book later. And I watched Star Wars on the way to Paris. That's a good movie. That's a really good show.
Yeah, hard not to like it.
I don't know if you guys have heard about this, but there's this thing called Star Wars.
Oh, yes.
They just put out a movie. Harrison Ford's in it, and Princess Leia, and the whole, and you know, some of the old characters and some of the new characters. Really good movie. And then coming back, I watched Creed. And I didn't want to watch it, you know, but I looked behind me. And my producer, Griffin, was on the flight with us. Griffin went with us. So Griffin's there, and he's behind me like about 8 or 9 rows and over a few seats, and the movie comes up, and I knew Griffin had seen it, I knew he'd liked it, I knew he wanted me to see it, and I knew he could see that I wasn't watching it. So every now and then I'd look back there, and he's looking at me like, oh, you gonna watch this? Hey, look, Creed's up on the screen, watch Creed. He was saying that with his eyes. So finally I plugged in and watched it, and that's a good movie too.
I didn't know I was saying all that, but
yeah, you were kind of badgering me back there silently with your eyebrows over the top of the seat in front of you. And I thought, all right, Griffin, leave me alone, stop yelling at me with your eyebrows. And so I watched it, and I thought that movie was just charming. It was a really good show.
It's phenomenal. Oh, it's the best. And those two movies, we didn't plan this, but it's funny, they have a lot of similarities. They are both the 7th installments in movie franchises, Rocky and Star Wars, 7 installments for both those. Both those franchises started in 1977, I think.
Yeah, about right. Yeah, if not.
They both mark the first time in both of those film franchises that, like, the main creative force, George Lucas and Sylvester Stallone, gave up the reins. And they're both really good.
Wow, so, I didn't know any of that.
George Lucas directed all the Star Wars movies up until 7, and Sylvester Stallone wrote all the Rocky movies up until Creed.
Huh.
And it looks like that's what they both needed, because they're both really good movies.
George Lucas is the topic of the Mincing Rascals conversation after 1:30. You'll hear Eric Zorn, Kristen McQuarrie from the Tribune, and our own Steve Bertrand and I kicking around the Narrative Art Museum that is or is not going to go up on the lakefront. It was a very spirited conversation that you can hear on my Facebook page. I'm King John on Facebook. And there is our weekly podcast of the Mincing Rascals. Part of that you'll hear after 1:30. I just want to take you back to Paris for a second. The other thing I realized when we landed in Paris is that, to me, that is one of those exotic, far-flung, once-in-a-lifetime places that people go to that ain't me. And after watching Star Wars and a movie, having a couple of meals, you get off the plane, hey, you're in Paris. It can be done. I don't know. It was kind of a revelation to me. It didn't seem so difficult to get there. And I found the city very quickly is much more English-friendly than I thought it would be. The people are much more American-friendly than I thought they would be. I didn't find the city to be overly expensive, no more so than Chicago. In fact, when we would go to a bistro or nicer restaurant in Paris and order a bottle of wine, that would cost 14 euro. They weren't pushing expensive wine on us. We'd get something like a bottle of wine. Think about that. You'll pay 14, the equivalent euro, for a glass of wine in Chicago.
Easy, yeah.
We were ordering bottles that way, and what do we know? It was pretty good. Maybe we made it better because we're ordering a bottle of wine in France, so how could it be bad? But I thought it was good. We had a really nice time that way. When you're in France, though, you land, and so they take you from the airport to your hotel, and as you are making your way along the streets, the narrow streets, the graffiti-filled streets in some instances, it's always discouraging in Europe to see how much of it is marked with that paint everywhere. But you're looking over the horizon wondering, where's the Eiffel Tower? Where's the Eiffel Tower? The same way you might in New York when you are hopeful to glimpse for the first time the Statue of Liberty. You know, that's a moment. And there it was in the distance, just the tip of it. And so we were really anxious to finally get to the Eiffel Tower and see that. We stayed at a hotel along the Seine. And another nice thing about visiting Paris, I discovered, is that it reminded me a little bit of San Francisco in that a lot of the things you want to see and do are actually pretty close together. from our hotel on the Seine, we could walk to Notre Dame. It would have been a bit of a hike, but people did it in our group. The Louvre was right across the river from us. The Eiffel Tower I jogged to one morning. The Musée d'Orsay, which is one of these great museums, is a walk, a 10-minute walk from our hotel. The Arc de Triomphe was not that far away. The Luxembourg Gardens were a short walk from where we were staying. So it's very accessible if you find yourself in the center of the city. We created a Facebook page called King John in Paris, and the group was posting pictures and sharing comments there. That's a fun way to travel with a group, just to make a Facebook page for y'all. Maybe you've done that, but it's the first time I've been involved in that. And when we got back, I said, okay, what were your highlights? What were the things that you liked doing the best while you were in Paris? For me, it was, subject to change, the Eiffel Tower lunch. So when we finally took our trip to the Eiffel Tower, here's a tip. If you want to stand in a line for a few hours, you and your family can go up the Eiffel Tower. If you make reservations in advance for the restaurant, like a third of the way up, well, then you've got reservations and you get in a different, shorter line. So do that.
Is that still called the Jules Verne restaurant? What used to be called that?
There may be, I think it was called like 57 okay. or something like that. It had a number associated with it, maybe the equivalent of how many floors you would be up. But it was really the first floor of the Eiffel Tower. And it was a lovely restaurant. And I thought, we're going to get tourist food. It was really good food, and it was a good view. We had a nice time doing that. Then we went to the Garden of Versailles. By the way, one other note. And the Garden of Versailles was my highlights were the Eiffel Tower, the Garden of Versailles, and maybe one moment in the tour bus that I'll get to in just a minute. The Gardens of Versailles are just spectacular. The word gardens does not do them justice. It's a sprawling acreage of trees and ponds and statuary. It's unlike anything I've seen in the United States, and Chicago's got pretty good landscaping. It's just something else. It's worth the trip unto itself. And the Eiffel Tower is just spectacular, and at night it's lit up. And there was one night we did a dinner on a little riverboat on the Seine. You know, you're on the little riverboat, it goes up and down, they play music, they serve you food and wine, and you look out the windows. It wasn't a narrative sort of thing. They weren't giving us touristy stuff. We were all just talking amongst ourselves. And as we got close to the end of the trip, we all kind of noticed some sort of activity up by where the band was playing, and there was a young man on one knee holding a diamond ring out to a young lady. And it's kind of cliche, but it was so perfectly cliche. You know, it was real, this poor kid. He's in front of a bunch of strangers, and he's proposing to his girlfriend. And we all kind of lean in, and then she says yes, and everybody claps. And it was so fun to witness that for them. And he was pumped. She was not as pumped, but he was so excited. And so he's walking up and down the center of the restaurant, virtually high-fiving us strangers. I said to him, thanks for sharing that moment with us. He said, we traveled 13 hours for this moment. It was a really big deal to him. And then as we got off the boat, we got back into our little bus. I'll finish my travelogue with this note. And we headed our way back to the hotel. And as we were in the bus, our tour guide, who was just an excellent lady named Fanny, and boy, a good tour guide makes a difference. She just started to, she talked to us a little bit, and then there was a pause, and then she just started to sing.
Pour la vie, et dès que je l'aperçois, alors je sens en moi mon cœur qui bat.
And that spontaneous moment was for a lot of us kind of a highlight.
That is cool.
Yeah, it was fun. So I'm back, and if we take a trip again, come with me. By the way, Steve Bertrand's taken a couple of trips. This was one of his trips. I'll give you just a note on in a minute. And also, Brenda and I are going with the group on the Danube in the fall, and I'll tell you how you could be part of that if you're interested. And then Bob will do the news at 1:30. And just after that, then, the Mincing Rascals are on their mark, ready to talk about the Narrative Art Museum that will or won't happen and some politics here on WGN. Thank you, Bob. Somebody just called Griff, said Buckingham Fountain fires up at 4.
Okay.
And you said goes until October. So
mid-October, yeah.
Doesn't feel like it, but December officially starts maybe today in Chicago. So on Friday, we record a Mincing Rascals podcast, and we post it at WGNplus.com. You can subscribe to it as a podcast, and I always post a link to it on my Facebook page. I'm King John on Facebook. Here is an excerpt from this week's Mincing Rascals.
I'm Eric Zorn from the Tribune, and I write a column you can read on Wednesdays, Fridays, and Sundays.
And I'm Krista McQuarrie. I write editorials and a column every other Friday that you can read in the Tribune. And today I'm right below Eric Zorn. Our pictures are
sharing.
We're poor neighbors.
By that you mean in the newspaper, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, I'll take it now. I'm Steve Bertrand, the host of the Business Lunch on WGN Radio, news anchor, and host of Steve Bertrand on Books, the podcast at WGNplus.com.
Well, let's break from form, guys. We always start talking presidential politics, and you know who. We'll get to that quick enough, but just as fascinating to me this week, because I don't want to talk first about Donald Trump in a taco bowl, is the whole Narrative Art Museum controversy in Chicago. What is the general consensus? Does everybody agree with the Tribune editorial that the Friends of the Parks at least have some standing here? We ought to let this thing play out in court?
Well, if you don't agree with the editorial, you certainly should.
did you write that one,
Kristen? I did not write that one. But, you know, the George Lucas and his wife kind of came out swinging this week. They view this as, you know, slapping away a huge investment, a gift to the city of Chicago. But there's law protecting the lakefront, and there just doesn't seem to be appetite among aldermen, among city residents at this time when the schools are about to go bankrupt. The teachers are talking about striking later this year. Crime is ratcheting up. A taxpayer-subsidized museum homage to George Lucas, it's not popular. I don't see this actually happening. I think they're going to go elsewhere. What do you think?
Well, there's two things there, right? I mean, one is the cost that you're referring to. They give, what, $800 million, but then the city still has to put up, somebody's got to come up with another billion or so. But then it's the location issue, too, right? The Friends, I don't think, would be fighting it, would they, Kristen, as vigorously if it were on the other side of Lakeshore Drive?
I think they'd be welcoming it if it were
on
the other side of Lakeshore Drive. A lot of people have suggested that. You know, I kind of liked the parking lot location. I thought that made some sense. You know, what was between Soldier Field and McCormick Place, this new idea where they're going to tear down McCormick Place East, that seemed like there were a lot of moving parts, a lot of finances, a lot of extra visitor taxes going into that. That didn't strike me that well. And my general sense is, look, George Lucas, we got some prime areas in this town where you could have a nice museum and a lot of visitors visit you. We don't want to give you our lakefront. Get lost.
Yeah, but he's got his heart set on a lakefront location, aww. Eric.
I think sometimes there are stories that come up that the media gets all exercised about and the politicians and the groups and things like that that most people really don't even care about. And I think most people, I couldn't care less about a museum in any way, where it is or what it is. And I think this is one of those stories that is sort of media class driven that most people they don't care.
Or maybe don't understand what it is. I mean, I know we've talked about that.
It's another museum that they won't go to. That's what it is.
Of narrative art. And I, despite everything that's been written about it, I still think people think it would be a Star Wars museum. Don't you, Steve? And
it's
whether
not.
Or not they go. I know. Well, you better go door to door.
Read the editorial page.
I want to rethink my position then.
I know, but I'm just saying, I think people see Lucas and they go to the Star Wars Museum. And it's not, I don't know if it's going to have Star Wars wing or not. But
there are all kinds of little interesting variables here. There's the whole thing of George Lucas, this guy from California coming in and taking part of our lakefront. There's a location. There's the mayor's involvement. I've found myself wondering, what if this were like the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and they said, we're going to relocate from Canton, Ohio. We'd like to have this spot right here next to Soldier Field. I think the town would feel a lot differently about that. I think that there would be much less patience for the Friends of the Parks and this idea that the lakefront is, you know, must be, you know, somehow sanctified. Right now we're sitting on land, I believe, that is former Lakeville, isn't it?
Oh, sure, you are. Absolutely.
Everything from Michigan Avenue is all like, we're all built on rubble, basically, that was reclaimed lakefront. So the idea that there's something sacred about reclaimed lakefront, I think it's like a lot of us figuring into this general civic feeling like, now we're not sure we want to go there, but how about a spot like at the Michael Reese property right across Lakeshore Drive? How about some other places that are in town that are near the lake but aren't right on our lakefront?
Have you guys been to other big cities, though, that did not preserve their lakefronts?
Yes.
And
just about all of them.
Yeah.
Well, so that's why it's so precious, because not many big cities have done what we have done and made it public space and made it open space. And there is genuine concern that if you allow this proposal in, or so I disagree with you if it were the Pro Football Hall. I don't care what it is. I think there is a genuine interest in protecting and keeping the lakefront open.
Krista McCrory hates football.
No, but it's weird because
she didn't deny it. Did you see that?
She laughed.
She did not deny it.
But if it were the parking lot location, you know, south of Soldier Field, I mean, what would we be losing? But I find myself more on the principal side of this thing. You guys sound to me like you're taking the beautiful lakefront property in Chicago for granted.
Kristen is definitely on your side on this.
Oh, absolutely. But Steve doesn't seem to care. And I'm thinking, Steve, you should care.
I don't care that much. And
didn't you just hear me? I said, Steve, yeah, I know. You should care.
You're supposed to
look,
care.
We've got a lot of.
This isn't North Park. This isn't North Avenue Beach.
No,
I mean, this is part of it. This is part of the.
And even North
authority.
Avenue Beach is a wonderful thing.
Well, it
is.
It's North Avenue. If this were on North Avenue Beach, some sort of part of the lakefront, the part that's really unspoiled. This is part of an area, the lakefront that we have basically trashed since we put Soldier Field there in McCormick
this
Place.
This isn't going to keep anyone from enjoying the lakefront.
The
right?
Tribune is responsible for that location of McCormick Place East. I mean, these are not our current colleagues, obviously. It was back in the 60s, but the Tribune agitated really strongly to put that monstrosity right on the lakefront.
I don't think there'd be any great offense to the lakefront to put the museum there. I mean, very few people are down there at the lakefront anyway, right? That property.
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's not used. No. But
it's unused. So why would we put something there that would be used?
It's a slippery slope thing. And by the way, Steve, doesn't it kind of bug you that, like Eric said, a billionaire from California comes to Chicago and says, I'll take that lakefront property there, when we so value
I think Eric's term was taking the lakefront.
Our lakefront.
He's married to a Chicagoan, right? So he lives in Chicago quite a bit.
And we can't have a conversation like this in Chicago if it really gets animated without introducing the race card. And there was George Lucas's wife saying that this will keep black and brown children from experiencing some beautiful art or something like that.
That was just so out of line, I thought. I mean, really, you're going to introduce the race card when we've been talking about all these issues, the law, protecting the lakefront, the fact that we can't afford it. I mean, she took all of the actual issues around this and tried to make it about race.
She should move it to Washington Park, right? They were going to put the Olympics there. Maybe the children could go to the museum.
How about next to the Barack Obama Library, which is going to be in Lawndale?
The consequences to Mayor Emanuel right now, who's already reeling from all these various problems with the schools and crime, and suddenly he's got this, and it looks like he's going to fail. They've gone to federal court, right? They're looking
to the appellate court.
I'm sorry, you're right. They're going to the appellate court. They're trying, and they're going to get a ruling by next Wednesday. But most people who I've heard talk about this say it's a real long shot. And essentially, what they're asking for is for the Friends of the Park suit to be thrown out immediately, so that they can begin groundbreaking, essentially.
Yeah, because we know how fast these things get thrown up. If we miss that deadline in 4 weeks, the whole thing is shot, right?
Well, George Lucas, you know, he's 70-some years old, and I think he wants to get this project going. He doesn't seem to have... He doesn't
Wait a minute.
Exactly.
Whoa, really?
Exactly.
Really?
Yes. No, he has surprising little patience for this process right now. He doesn't
You brought up the Football Hall of Fame, but do you think also people would be less opposed if George didn't look so smug?
I don't know. Kristen Decker, our producer of this podcast, was at a rally the other day, and she got the sense and was talking to me about it that people are also seeing this as an extension of Rahm Emanuel. And so it really doesn't have any natural allies right now. They don't like Lucas. You know, what business is this of his, say? And then Rahm Emanuel isn't maybe the sort of person that Chicagoans are going to rally around on this expanse.
Well,
right,
Father Flager's behind it, and Jesse Jackson Sr. is behind it. And there are, in some community leaders, especially in the South, outside an African American community, are behind this.
They are meaningless. They are absolutely meaningless. And John is right that this is an extension of what people, you know, continually criticize the mayor for, is focusing on downtown, shiny baubles, not paying attention to neighborhoods that actually need, you know, serious economic development. And this is an extension of that. I mean, that's why he was in a runoff last year, for this exact reason.
And to get that kind of private investment, you still have to spend more than the private investment. Is it financially viable, would you say?
No.
Is it a smart move for the city or state?
No.
So the governor is kind of vacillating on this, though. Am I right? He doesn't like the east side, but he's agreeable to the idea of it going where the parking lot is.
I think that's the Zorn position, yes.
Wow. Mark that
down. More commonly known.
Yeah. Right.
But more interestingly, we'll segue now to the governor's position on Donald Trump in the Republican field, which is now Donald Trump. He said he's not going to be a delegate. He said he's not going to go to the convention, and he won't endorse Donald Trump. Bully for you, eh? Is there any risk for Governor Rauner and that, guys?
No.
I think you're going to see
Illinois voted for Trump.
Well, I don't think endorsements really matter. And I think you're going to see a lot of governors and other people saying the same thing. I support him, but I am not going to endorse him.
What does that mean? That I'm going to vote for him, but I'm not going to raise money for him?
Or I'm not going to, you know, fight against him.
I'm going to stand on a dais with him and join hands together. That's a
complicit endorsement. And I don't exactly understand that. To me, you either are in or you are out. And if you are not actively saying something against his candidacy, then that's an endorsement. Is that a fair assessment on my part?
I don't think that's fair. No, I think there's a vast difference between keeping quiet. The Bush family apparently is going to keep quiet about this. They're not going to say anything. And actually coming out and speaking. When you endorse a candidate, especially presidentially, you'll go around to rallies. You will give introductions. You will help raise money. And there's a big difference between just like voting for somebody or not, or tacitly going along with the party.
Bob Dole will be the only living Republican presidential nominee at the convention.
Yeah, for the last five.
Right?
Think about that.
All the others are taking a pass.
Aren't even going to go. So that's Eric Zorn, Kristen McQuarrie, I'm John Williams, and Steve Bertrand from the Mincing Rascals podcast. And you can tell the gang was just starting to get wound up there on the presidential political scene. Talk a little Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Obviously, a lot of attention this week with Donald Trump, what with him winning Indiana and sealing up the nomination. And so the gang went at that. You can continue to listen to that podcast. You can find it a couple of ways. One way is to subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes. You can always check it out at WGNplus.com. You'll see a cartoon of the four of us around a table. I think somebody has their hands over my mouth in that picture. And I always post a link to it on my Facebook page, where I am King John. I think at some point we talked a little bit more about that bizarre picture on Cinco de Mayo of Donald Trump leaning over a great big taco bowl that he got at the grill in the Trump Towers. And he said, "Happy Cinco de Mayo. The best Mexican food is at the Trump Tower Grill. I love Hispanics." I thought when I first saw that, that was from The Onion. I thought, this is a parody of Donald Trump. That's classic pandering. That's condescension times a million. And no, that was actually Trump's honest-to-God tweet. You'd think like the next day he would say, an intern got a hold of that and we take it back. That's the way anybody else would handle it. Trump just doubled down. What a story. What a crazy time. We'll pause here. This is WGN.
I want to know what you did to this guy that he's after you.
I didn't do anything.
Well, you must have done something.
No, he just doesn't like me.
Doesn't like you? How could anyone not like you?
I know, it seems impossible.
Doesn't like you? How could that be?
Ma, I know this may be hard for you to understand, but I'm sure there are many people who do not like me.
Jerry, don't say that.
It's true.
No, it isn't. It's not true. You're a wonderful, wonderful boy. Everybody likes you. It's impossible not to like you. Impossible. Morty?
Maybe some people don't like him. I can see that.
Not bad. If nothing else, you will always, you know, the children will always be the kids and the moms will always be the moms. What a great line from Seinfeld. Jerry. So speaking of Seinfeld, though, I got one other soundbite for you here. This is with the Kentucky Derby in mind. Do you remember this scene from Seinfeld?
The little fella's been riding his heart out. They're going to break his maiden.
Really? Yeah, but it's a little slow out there. It rained last night.
Oh, this baby loves the slop. Loves it. Eats it up. Eats the slop. Born the slop. His father was a mutter.
His father was a mutter.
His mother was a mutter.
His mother was a mutter.
What did I just say?
So I'm reading from Bloomberg And they have a story about one horse named Uncle Mo, who, and I guess there's two horses in the Kentucky Derby this year that have sired three of the horses in it. So Uncle Mo's not running in the Kentucky Derby, but three of the horses in the Derby are from Uncle Mo, and there's another horse that provided, that sired three of the horses in there. I think that's the first time that's happened. And so they were just talking about this Uncle Mo horse, and they said, think of it this way. There's 1,600 stallions providing stud services in the United States. So they, or their children, if you will, are all vying for the 20 coveted Kentucky Derby slots. It's pretty remarkable that one horse for those 20 slots would have provided for three with that many others competing. It's a risky, competitive business. But if it goes well, boy, it can go really well. Uncle Mo's owner says, the industry says, that horse is probably worth now $100 million. The stud fee service, wouldn't you love to get paid $75,000 per servicing, if you will? $75,000 a service. And if it goes well, if it goes better at the Kentucky Derby, the fee for this horse could go up to $150,000 per servicing. And servicing is, I think, being used now for the first time ever.
What do they call it before?
I don't know what. I have a lot of things I can call it, but I don't want to call that on the radio. I don't know what you call that when the one horse gets together with the other horse. So anyway, when that happens, the one guy gives the other guy $75,000. And if the Kentucky Derby is favorable to Uncle Mo's kids, the fee could go up to $150,000. And this is a horse that provides this service 200 times a season. How many of us can say we provided the service 200 times this season? Raise your hands. At $150,000 a pop, potentially. Isn't that amazing? And the guy paid $200,000 for the horse. So he's more than making his money back. Yeah, that's a $100 million horse. By the way, do you guys, Bob, do you watch the TV show Silicon Valley?
I've seen some of the episodes. It's hilarious. I love that show.
Griffin, do you know why I'm bringing up Silicon Valley?
Yes, I do. I think I have a pretty good idea.
So there's a series called Silicon Valley on HBO, and in it, the billionaire owner of a website or some major company in the Silicon Valley is into horse racing. And the one guy goes to see him at the horse stall where the one horse is servicing another horse. And they showed it graphically at length. And I've never seen that. Never seen it on TV. Movies are real. I thought, I was like shocked. I was like, you can't be showing this.
It's not TV. It's HBO.
It's graphic. It was like horse porn we were watching.
It actually was. Yeah, it was not. I don't think that was simulated.
No, I don't think it was simulated. And they didn't do anything to sort of like, well, if we put the camera here, you won't really see what's happening. No, they showed it. And they showed it a lot. And the one character who's just coming to the barn to meet the owner, he is really uncomfortable with it. And he was us, right? Because you're looking at this going, oh, gee, oh, my gosh. Holy cow, what am I looking at here? And he was the same way. He's like, I'm real uncomfortable. Could we just talk about this around the corner? And I'm like, yeah, let's get around the corner. Go around. I cannot continue. And it was hilarious, but also just amazing. And words fail me after that.
I think it's good that they showed that a week before the Kentucky Derby. It's like, if you enjoy the race, that race doesn't happen without this.
Without this. I know.
$75,000 transaction.
Transaction, another word. It's time for the news. We'll get to that next on WGN. Happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there, Bob. I know you'll second me on that.
Yes, indeed.
And to my wife, Brenda, who's not my mother, and to my mother, who's probably listening to us in Arizona right now on the stream, happy Mother's Day, and thank you all. Vivian Maier is a great story. Did you see the Tribune story about her earlier this week? And when they wrote about it, when Jason Meisner wrote about it, I thought, oh, shoot, I remember I've talked to that guy, John Maloof, before a couple of times. And now it's back in the news and may be in the news again this week. John joins us on WGN Radio. John, how are you? Welcome again to the show.
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
By the way, I have your book in front of me, at least one that you edited, Vivian Meyer, Street Photographer. Have you put out many books of her photography? Is this just the one? How many are there?
We did three, so that was the first one, and then we did a self-portrait book, and after that we did a bigger book that kind of encompasses her color work and later work as well.
Got it. So the headline is Tentative Settlement Reached in Fight Over Photographer Vivian Meyer's Estate. Meisner said a tentative settlement has been reached in the long-running dispute over the work of amateur street photographer Vivian Meyer, the reclusive Chicago nanny who rocketed to posthumous fame after tens of thousands of her undeveloped photographs were found in an old storage locker. Before we get to the settlement, tell us a little bit about how you came up to have these, the film and the photographs themselves, John.
Well, it's really a long story to unpack, but I'll try to be concise. I was working on a history book on the neighborhood of Portage Park in Chicago, and I needed some photographs. So I went to a local auction house, and I saw some, you know, a box of seemingly never-ending amount of negatives, and I won the box at the auction, and didn't use them for the book because none of them kind of like related to it. But later, I started to scan them, and over time, I realized that these were much better images than I had originally thought when I bought them. And
how many images did you buy, John?
Well, the original box was roughly like 30 to 40,000 negatives. And then as soon as I started to realize that these weren't just some hobbyist or something, I contacted a lot of people that bought other boxes and started to try to put the archive back together by buying their work that they bought.
I see. And were those negatives?
I bought like 100,000, let's say, roughly 100,000 negatives altogether. Yeah.
100,000 negatives. And you're saying negatives. Does that mean then film that's been developed? Did you also buy undeveloped film?
Yes. So that includes the undeveloped film negatives.
I see.
There's about 2,000 rolls of black and white film and maybe 600 roughly rolls of color film that we still haven't processed, and thousands of vintage photographs, some of which she printed herself, and of course negatives.
So you own most of her work then, right? I mean, kind of put that in perspective for me.
Yeah, that's true. I own most of it. I would say around 90% of what's known, and that it would include all of her artifacts, such as cameras and notes and, you know, letters, you know, stuff that she collected, other art, and, you know, her kind of notorious hats that she wore and stuff like that. So there's a lot of, I would call it ephemera, that actually is more, takes up much more space than the actual art itself.
So I'm looking at this one book that I have. You say there are three, and some of our listeners are probably familiar with some of the Vivian Meyer work now just because she's been in the news the last few years and because her images are just so amazing. It's street photography. She walks around Chicago. She traveled a little bit, but a lot of the locations you might recognize as being Chicago-ish. And it's people living their everyday lives. The photographs I'm looking at are black and white, but yet they're such interesting people, or they're such ordinary people with interesting emotions, faces, scenes, expressions, struggling with a police officer, kids about to light a bottle rocket, somebody walking in or out of a store. I don't know how it is that when she looks through the camera, she sees such interesting stories, and she captures them at just the right moment. I mean, they're paintings, these photographs, and their stories. It's just remarkable what she's able to do with the camera on film. I presume you agree with that assessment.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I saw that, you know, originally what caught my eye as somebody who wasn't even a photographer at the time, I was, you know, interested in the history of Chicago. So the cityscapes and the architecture back then is what kind of got me excited. And this is not something that was in the film at all, because it's kind of like another longer story to unpack. But I got inspired to become a photographer because I started to go try to recreate some of her images, and that kind of led me down the path of photography. And in learning photography and taking classes and starting my own darkroom in my house and stuff like that, I kind of learned by process and, you know, doing it, that the work was better because of how extremely skillful she had to have been, based on how hard I could see that this must be to do.
Yeah.
You know, so that was one of the kind of moments for me, that made me think there's something more than just a hobbyist here.
Do we have any sense that she realized how good she was? Had she even, obviously the undeveloped stuff she never saw. Do you know if she knew how good she was?
Yeah, I think she did. She, in the documentary we made, Finding Vivian Maier, we present a letter that she wrote to a lab in France, and the lab, in the lab, she says, basically, these are my masterpieces that I want to print, and I'm doing all these night shots, and I think you will like them. And she basically is talking a lot of, you know, I guess, good about her own work to this lab.
Yeah. Well, I guess you get to talk the talk if you can walk the walk, and her stuff is amazing. So you acquired these images, the film, the negatives. You realized you had something. You started to post them online. People started to notice them. And then it became kind of a legal battle over who has the rights to them. You may have the film, but does that give you the rights to use them and profit from them? She had no... She wasn't married. She didn't have kids, right? So the question became, who's the heir to the Vivian Maier estate, right?
Yeah, you know, I would just want to clarify that a lot of people think there's a lawsuit and there's this court battle. There's no lawsuit with me, at, you know, and there's, you know, there's no, like, court battle. Basically what happened is I tracked down an heir using many genealogists, and found an heir in France that, to our knowledge, was the best person to make an agreement with, and we made an agreement. And some guy, you know, took it upon himself to go kind of, like, find somebody else and contest that, and opened a probate case for her estate. And, you know, I'm not an expert in all this probate stuff, so I don't really know the right terms. But the bottom line is an estate was... started, and you know, I basically had to work out an agreement with them because it was very, very difficult to know who the heir is right now, and that's why it's going on for so long, is because it's kind of a unique situation. It's not like the family's there waiting, you know.
Yeah. When you found a family member, a distant family member in France, that must have been an odd phone call for him to get. Hi, I'm from Chicago. You have a relative you never knew of who has this trove of photographs that may be worth something, and I want to pay you for the rights to them. Was that kind of your overture to this guy?
No, it wasn't, actually. The lead to that was through a lot of my needle in the haystacks research on finding the village that she visited multiple times. And so once I found that she was, once I identified the name of this village, I had a genealogist kind of in that area go and contact the mayor and try to find the family roots. And then he confirmed that there are roots, and that people knew her there. The person that I found, actually, yeah, he remembers her. He has some of her things, some of her mother's things, photographs she made of him and for him and stuff like that. So this is somebody that I thought, well, there's no one alive that is related to her that is, you know, closer, I guess, in a family way, you know, to Vivian Maier. And you know, we figured this is the best person to try to work this out with.
So you did?
Yeah, so we did. And, you know, this is not. We weren't 100%. You know, we were confident that we were like as close as we could possibly be. But you know, it's like there's what I found out is you have to be able to prove 100% that there's nobody closer, and that's nearly impossible to do, right? With this situation at this current point. So yeah, I mean, we can't. You know, we can't do that. So anyway, you know.
So what happens next week then? So then what's this pending settlement?
The estate was working in agreement back and forth with me for a while, and we finally came upon an agreement. And so I really don't know. I think basically it's a procedural thing where this has to kind of go in front of the right person to see and approve, and then we can kind of all move forward.
I expected you'd have the legalese language down better than this, John.
I'll be honest with you, I didn't even know of this court date until the press called me.
Really? No kidding. But I think it's next week. You might want to check your calendar and make sure you've got some time free, because here was my hope. I've always thought that you came upon this honestly, and you did due diligence to try and find anybody who might have a connection to her or the photographs. But it's finders keepers in my world. That shows you how much legalese I know. But you came upon them honestly. You did due diligence. If you want to publish them, and if you profit from that, I don't have any problems with that. Vivian isn't here, and her kids aren't either. She doesn't have a husband who's standing around going, where's my share of it? So I'm quote-unquote on your side on this thing. And what I want to see happen, and I don't know if this is possible now, is this where it can go, John, is you can now develop those 600 other roles. Who knows what's in there? You can publish them. You can make movies. You can do, you know, museum gallery shows. But this could be your little cottage industry. Somebody should be putting this stuff forward.
Well, that's the hope. You know, that's the whole point of this agreement, is so that it's worthwhile for me to continue and to have people, you know, staff and whoever, working on this archive and to process the rest of the roles and to work on other exhibits and stuff like that. That's the goal. And I think, you know, everybody agrees that, you know, they don't want to, you know, make that go away. You know, there's no incentive to, you know, stop everything when, you know, everybody's enjoying the work. And we're, you know, I am doing my very best to get the best people I can involved in this project in a way where it's not going to compromise the, you know, integrity of the work, or, you know, make it seem cheap or whatever.
Hold on a second, John. Yeah. Where are the rolls of film, those 600 undeveloped rolls of color film? Where are those?
They are in a refrigerator waiting to be processed in a lab. I finally made the shipment to the archival place to just kind of be on the sidelines, ready to roll, and they're refrigerated.
Well, as they should be. And then, I mean, but yeah, I used to develop color film or send it to the photo mat. It didn't cost that much, but I mean, somebody's going to open them up, develop them. You're going to see what you got.
No,
right?
They're a lot of money. This is film from various different years. So most of them are from the 70s, but there's also a film up to the 1999. I think
1990s anyway, I saw.
1990s for sure. I don't know if it goes up to 99, it might. But, okay, so here's the main thing that is expensive with this, is that each batch that Kodak made with different, you know, whatever, years and different codes has to be snip tested and tested with a custom batch of chemistry to see if they can maximize. Because this specific type of film, ektachrome, fades extremely fast over time, and it doesn't hold up well. And so they have to, you know, they have to really do a lot of labor-intensive processing on this type of film. So
yeah,
this is really expensive to do.
So here's my last question for you. I mean, and it may not be the most important thing, but do you have any sense of what you've got here? That is this $1 million estate for you now? I mean, do you think that you're going to be able to get kind of rich off of this or be profitable with this?
I don't think of it that way. I mean, I work on it. I work, you know, full time on the archive, and a lot of people work on this. And you know, I don't think of it like a business. I think of it as a long term project that I think it was a very important thing for the art world and, you know, the history of photography. You know, of course, you know, everybody has to be able to pay the bills, and, you know, nobody can take their whole life and put it to something and get by. So yeah, there has to be some sort of payment somewhere, but it's not something I think about of, you know, what is it worth? And I have no idea. I don't think of it that way though.
Yeah. Vivian Meyer, the street photographer, John Maloof is the guy that found it and collected it and has it. An agreement is supposed to. Now, our interview is over, John. We got to go, but you're going to something this coming week, right? You're going to meet somebody in a room and somebody's going to sign something?
I'm not personally doing anything.
Okay.
I would never invite them. So I don't have any to go. I think that's all going to.
You should read the Tribune. There's a story about you.
No, I was interviewed. I understand, and I followed up with everybody that's going, you know, involved in this, and they said, yeah, I guess, you know, this is just part of the procedure. We have me personally, and, you know, my attorney, don't have to be there for whatever this is about. You know, this is not. Yeah.
All right. Well, good luck to you, John. I can't wait to see what else Vivian Meyer has in store for us. Thanks for your time this afternoon.
Yeah, I appreciate that, and thanks for your support.
That's John Maloof. Yeah, I support Vivian Meyer and him. Vivian Meyer, Street Photographer, is the title of the book that he edited. All right, 2:25. The news coming up around the corner on WGN. Thank you, Bob Kessler, John Williams, WGN Radio. All right, Griff, this is our Vibe Score segment. You always start us out with a musical vibe. What are we listening to here?
Radiohead. This is their first new music in 5 years, and wow. It's called Burn the Witch.
Burn the Witch. They dropped two new singles this week. Is that right? I think that's what I heard.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, they just released Daydreaming yesterday along with a video directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, Boogie Nights, There Will Be Blood director.
What did you think of the video? What did you think of the song?
It was cool. I've never been the biggest Radiohead fan. I respect them very much, but it always takes me a while to kind of get into their stuff. So I'm excited for their new album, but I didn't go nuts for it. The video was cool.
Yeah, the one with the claymation?
Yeah. Yeah, well, that was the other one. That was for this song, Burn the Witch, and it's getting, let me look it up, whoops, a 71 on Vibe Score right now.
Vibe Score is a new app. My cousin and I developed it. If you download the Vibe Score app, you can get it for free. Put it on your phone. We'll feed you news and stories in the categories that you pre-select, like Chicago sports, health and fitness, Chicago TV, music, movies. And at the end, you're asked to score them. For instance, we, in the fashion category, gave you some of the outfits from the Met Gala this year. We asked you about Beyonce's Klingon peach-colored work of art that she was wearing. I gave it a very high score. Did you see the picture of Beyonce at the Met Gala, Griff? Holy cow, what a dress. So let me see what her number is right now. She is getting an 88. Good scores for Beyonce's dress at the Met Gala. Is Decker going to jump in on this one too, Griff?
I'm here.
What did you think of that outfit?
I gave it an 88, actually.
Great.
No, Beyonce
minds.
Looked so great in it. I loved, there weren't very many dresses that I didn't like at the Met Gala.
That's
actually
my attitude.
Engineer, or is it Gala? I always want
to. Gala. I don't know. I think you can say. I feel like everybody always says Met Gala. And then I'm with the two people in the world.
It sounds more fancy when it's a gala. I went to a gala once, but you went to a gala.
Engineer,
in Peoria, in Joliet, we call them galas, okay?
In Milford, it's gala.
Engineer Krista just brought up Claire Danes' dress. Did you see that? Because the theme was like the future or technology or something.
Technology.
And her dress lit up.
Oh, I did see that.
Yes. And it was amazing.
That was awesome.
It was a Zac Posen, and it was like such a fairy tale looking dress. I loved it.
I thought it was beautiful. I forgot
Claire Danes was wearing it.
I don't know if Lou Manfredini was on with Hoda and Kathy Lee the day they were doing this, but Kathy Lee and Hoda were talking about it. So they were showing up pictures. They showed the Madonna picture from the backside, and I guess her cheeks were showing. And so they put a big red bow over the cheeks. They animated it there so that we wouldn't be offended by Madonna's rear end being exposed.
I kind of expect that before.
I expect that from Madonna. Come on, it's not a dress really. You just happen to be wearing art. I thought the dresses were really fun. Okay, Griff, walk us through it. What else do we have on Vibe Score this week?
Well, you talked about the new Justin Timberlake song. Also on Vibe Score, and put that up right before the show started, and you're not going to be happy.
Why?
I feel like it. Okay.
I gave it an 87.
Thank you.
I love Justin Timberlake. I loved his last album, The 2020 Experience, and I'm excited for this new one. I like that new song. I'm all in. Rob Martier, our former newsman here on Saturdays, and
hi Rob, thank you for vibing
on WGN. He vibed it. Yeah, but you won't be happy. Gave it a 0.
Rob doesn't know music.
Maybe he made a mistake.
His comment is amazing to me. It says, total crap. And then it says, Uptown Funk with like 10 exclamation points. That's where it's at. Like, that's the only song that can be good. That's the only song. And if there's any other song, he doesn't want to hear it.
Wow,
and that's
Rob,
bringing you the news.
You are so dead to me. Hold on a second. This is the song we're talking about. I got this feeling.
Song of the summer.
I think it's got a great summer feel. I'll give you 20 seconds of it. Hold on. Here we go.
Off from my city, off from my home. We're flying up no ceiling when we in our zone. I got that sunshine in my pocket. Got that good soul in my feet. I feel that hot blood in my body when it drops.
That's all you need to know. It takes him about 20 seconds to get to the hook. It's awesome. It's a great song.
That's not even the hook.
I vibed it 95.
That's the bridge. Oh, Kristen, you gave it a 95. Yes.
Oh, that's the bridge? I didn't even get to the hook yet, huh, Griff?
I don't know. Yeah, either way, it's all good.
I think so.
But yeah, Rob, not a huge fan. So that's sitting at a 53 right now.
Come on, somebody go on Vibe Score and give JT his love. What else you got, Griff?
All right, in the Chicago category, this month marks the 10th anniversary of Chicago losing their bid for the 2016 Olympics. Are you happy or sad that they are not here? 100 is happy, 0 is sad.
What is it getting?
57. People are split on this.
Yeah, but, you know, to me, 57, I remember, I mean, we really wanted the Olympics, and we were stunned that we didn't even, that we finished, we were the first one out of the final group, and...
That was embarrassing, I will say. I would have liked to have at least made it to the final three.
I'll never forget it. Our phone lines lit up for hours after that, and people were angry, embarrassed, scratching their head, and then you see how difficult it is going for Rio. And so you think, okay, good, we dodged that bullet. But it doesn't really translate that way. We're not real. We'd probably be handling it better.
Yeah, but...
But if we can't even agree on the George Lucas Museum, how in the hell are we ever going to get anywhere with the Olympics?
I mean, the museum's one thing, or just, you know, anything else. I mean, nothing works right now. So I just feel like plopping the Olympics on top of that.
It would have all have been Rahm Emanuel's fault.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, okay, so then 57 is telling, isn't it? Because once upon a time, we were 100. We were 90.
Well, you would have been 0 for, yeah, well, it doesn't matter.
We were all in. But we really wanted it, and we didn't get it. Now you're like, hey, a 57, meaning, you know, we're glad we didn't get it. That's another way to read that. All right, give me another one, Griff.
In TV, Game of Thrones is back in its second season on HBO. And last week's episode had some major plot developments. We won't spoil, I guess, but I can't imagine anybody that follows the show not knowing what happened. Anyway, what is your score for the season so far? It's currently getting an 87.
87.
Don't watch it. Can't vote.
Yeah, you don't.
Well, I'll just say this. I don't think this is spoiling anything, Griffin. I think they've handled the Jon Snow character correctly. So
it's funny because it actually is like a spoiler just to even say his name.
But
you're right.
I 87 think, sounds right.
I'm very excited about this season for sure. And yeah, I ranked it somewhere like that.
What else we got?
News and current events. Hey, have you heard about this? Cruz and Kasich are out. And Trump will be the Republican nominee for president. Yeah.
Oh, I'm still crying.
Tell Kessler. I don't think that's even in the news yet.
I know. I was surprised he wasn't reporting it. Anyway, what is your score for this turn of events? 100 is I love it. 0 is I hate it.
Yeah.
And it's so, 34 right now.
Which is remarkably high, don't you think? That's a big number for the Donald.
I literally feel like some people might be changing their minds. It's kind of... I know. It's amazing.
There's a lot going on there, but I know that earlier on when we would put up a Trump vibe, he would score 10, 12, 3. I mean, people just dumped on him. Now 34. Still, you know, not 100, but he's inching up there. Okay. Give me another one, Griff.
And this is maybe a week or two old now, but it seemed like a good question anyway. In sports, Laremy Tunsil went from 1 to 13 in the NFL draft after a video of him hitting a gas mask bong was released.
Yeah.
Losing him roughly $8 million, I think was the number, or something like that.
Yeah, no, it was over 7, yeah.
Yeah, and would you draft him was our question. 100 is, of course, 0 is no way.
What did he get?
Well, what's your score? We haven't been giving our scores.
I'll give you mine. Yeah. I am a 75 on drafting him. I don't think we know that much about him, except that he has a very ingenious way to smoke marijuana. But, you know, take away the gas mask. You got a kid in college smoking some pot, whatever.
Big deal.
Who got his school to pay some of his mom's bills. And that's happened before. So, and then he was remarkably honest at the draft. I wasn't, you know, as alarmed by this. It was just the timing was bizarre, and that damn gas mask was bizarre.
I gave him
a 75.
75. I gave him an 88. I thought he showed, you know, some creativity in his past. He's honest. He accepted fault.
Look, these are all virtues.
And let's move on. 88. Is he good at football? Yes, that's all we care about.
And he knows how to create a viral video.
I know.
You can't
do
that.
He could be marketable.
Hey, listen,
that?
I'm a Minnesota Vikings fan, and the star halfback for that team hit his kid with a switch. So let's keep things in perspective.
I know, when the NFL commentators or people associated with the league get so righteous about this, I'm thinking, are you serious? Really?
Uh-huh.
It's getting a 43 right now, so people are a little torn, pretty close to the middle, but on the negative side. Anyway, in the movies category, Southside with You.
Oh, this movie, is interesting.
Yeah, the movie about Barack and Michelle Obama's first date. It has had its Sundance premiere and will open nationwide later this year. The trailer's out now. We posted the trailer, and you can watch it on VibeScore, and we asked, what do you think of the idea for a movie, and do you like the trailer?
Is this movie based on a real date they had?
Yeah, it's kind of their story that they talk about.
Their first date.
For their marriage, yeah. I think walking around Hyde Park.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, you know, loosely based on a true story, sure.
Okay. Well, I should love this movie. I'm a Barack Obama guy. It's a Chicago movie, blah, blah, blah. I think this looks sanctimonious and contrived. You know, they're walking around on a date, and he says, I want to help people. You know, what do you want to do? I want to be a community activist and do good for the country. I'm like, really? Was that your first date? And if it was, shut up. I don't want to hear this. It just looked contrived to me. I don't know. Did you guys see it that way? I gave it like 23 or something.
You did not. You gave it a 55. I'm on this app all the time.
That
I know what you gave it.
That's the moral equivalent of a 23. I should be at 100 for him. What did you think of the trailer, Griff?
What now, Kristen, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, I gave it a 70. I'm always up for a good rom-com.
I gave it a 70 also. I kind of agree with you. I mean, but I'm mostly just... always in the camp of don't judge it before you've seen it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
I just saw the trailer. It's a terrible movie.
I know. That is, you are the king of that. It drives me crazy. And but I do understand some of your criticism, so I'm not crazy high on it, but I think, you know, we'll see. I like the idea, and I give it a 70.
I didn't know this movie had to be made. I mean, it's kind of an interesting...
Why not?
I think when you take a famous couple or famous people and say, what was it like when they first intersected? That's an interesting conceit. You could make that kind of a movie about a lot of people. Mm-hmm. All I'm saying is what I saw in the trailer disappointed me. VibeScore is an app. Thank you, Kristen Decker, for popping in on that segment.
No
as
problem.
You do.
No problem. Welcome back from Paris.
Griff is our producer on this. We'll pause and then come back, say hi to the boys from the beat, and get ready for their sports show on WGN. Busy sports weekend. There's a horsey race and some baseball all on the docket here and elsewhere. Mark Carman is at Howells and Hood next to the Tribune Tower getting ready for their show downstairs. Why are you guys over there, Mark?
Well, we got an outstanding remote today, Ro. Your name is John Williams.
Is high praise, sir.
Yeah. Well, Ro's going to be here, so he's apparently on my mind. So we are out here. Adam is wearing his Sunday best, Derby best right now, John. I mean, I've just got a colorful shirt on. But Adam Hoge, my partner, he's got a little suit, vest, a tie. This guy looks ready for the Derby. I just want to let you know, if you were just wondering, that Adam's impressive today.
I was thinking of him with one of those big hats on and a blouse like Prince used to wear and something like that. But he's gone more the male kind of snappy, dapper guy look, huh?
Yeah, I don't... That would be interesting. No, I don't think I've ever worn a blouse, but I think I'm just wearing like – actually, I got married in this vest that I'm wearing right
really?
Now.
Really? How nice. Yeah. Well, good for you. It still fits, and you look great, I'm sure. So what are you guys doing today? Well, obviously, Derby talk?
Well, can I ask you a question, John, because we're going to try to figure this out throughout the show. I want to know what, if anything, the horse is thinking. Like, does the horse know that he's in a race? Does the horse know that it's a Kentucky Derby? Does he know it's a bigger race? If he's won the Kentucky Derby, does he know that he's in line for the Triple Crown? I mean, or is he just thinking about getting an apple? I mean, where do you come out on this?
I come out on the side of when they say greatest athletes of all time and some people want to put Secretariat in there. You can't, because the horse doesn't know. It's a horse. He likes to run, or he knows to run, but I think we give the horse way too much credit. What do you think?
Well, okay, so I was watching one of the earlier races today, and I've never seen this before, but basically one of the horses was running late to the race. So they had to delay the race a little bit. So
I can relate to that horse.
The reporter goes and talks to the trainer of the Tepin, which is like one of the greatest horses of all time.
Oh, yeah,
actually.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And asks the trainer, so is Tepin going to be okay? How is she handling this delay? And the trainer was like responding like, well, it's not a big deal. You know, she's used to this kind of stuff. She doesn't seem too bothered by it. I'm like, does she have any idea even what time the race starts?
Well,
I have to stand
here for 2 days. She doesn't know.
but if you're an experienced trainer and you know the mannerisms of Tepin,
yeah,
you know, you could see if the snout goes down. Do they have a snout? Does a horse have a snout? Is that fair to call
the long nose thing part of the horse? Yes,
right.
I know where that is.
Yeah, so I mean, if he sees a a downward snoutal trend, maybe he knows that Tepin is kind of bummed out.
I when we leave our house in the afternoon, say Brenda and I are going to go to the store or something, you wave goodbye to the dogs, you say, okay, we'll be right back, but for all they know, you're moving to China, and you'll never see them again. And I think that's why they're so happy when you come home, because they're like, holy crap, they're back, hooray. They don't know. I don't think they know, these horses. Some Derby talk.
That just made me feel really sad for the dog.
Oh, it's true. Like, my dog does the same thing. It's like every time you leave, they think you're never coming home. Even though you come home every single time.
When have I let you down?
Yeah.
By the way, are you guys enjoying this baseball season as much as I think everybody in Chicago should be?
I did the day-night doubleheader yesterday, John. It was at Wrigley in the afternoon and then down to the south side at night. Part of that was work duties, but I was at both with complete glee and joy and everything else. It was, I think it's phenomenal. And I don't know where you come out on this, but like if you could pick it, right? Cubs, you're in the World Series, or the White Sox, you're in the World Series. Do you want to play the other side of town, or do you want to play a random team? Because that would be, I mean, it would be insane regardless. But if they were actually playing each other, and we might as well talk about this because we're in May and they're both in first place and it may never happen again. I mean, I'm kind of curious what people think about that. What would you say?
Yeah, I know. I was talking to my son about that. He said it would be too much. The town couldn't handle it. I don't know what that means. Either one would be good. Obviously, it's the Cubs' turn, if you will, so I'm kind of rooting for that to happen. Well, I'm getting the signal. I got to stop talking to you guys. It sounds like you're in a good spot down there. Have a good time this afternoon.
Thanks, John. We're going to have a lot of fun.
Okay, the boys are at Howells and Hood next to the Tribune Tower, downtown Chicago. We'll wrap it up in a minute on WGN.